Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Well, here we are, January 7th, 2020. I think of 2020, the year, as also giving us maybe better vision, 2020, for more clarity. Probably the number one New Year's resolution is to lose weight. So, we're going to talk about eating disorders, and you can call in if you have a question, 888-874-4888. And my guest, Grace Bell, is a real expert in this, and she runs retreats and works with people online as well as in person. Welcome to this program, Grace Bell.
Why, thank you, Diana. It's great to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I've known Grace actually probably a little more than 10 years, but we recently connected. She's in Seattle, as I am. And so it was wonderful to reconnect with her. And she's the perfect person with which to explore this whole topic of eating disorders, because or sometimes, as you say, Grace, disordered eating. And because I have experience with this more when I lived in Palo Alto, and that was quite a few years ago. But still, I see an occasional client with it. So, Grace, you have a personal story, though, that led you to focus in on this after you worked with, after you became a certified facilitator of the work of Byron Katie.
That's
So tell all of us about why you were drawn, because you do work, and in fact, when we have you back on the program, we'll investigate the work a little more. But what you have a personal story that I'd like for you to share with the listening audience, because this is what makes you so good at this.
Yes, thank you. I know what makes us good is what we've been through, which was really hard. In a nutshell, I suffered from a severe eating disorder, bulimia, as well as 2 years of anorexia, hospitalized, therapy, dropped out of college, felt like it was really killing me. And unfortunately, it's one of the top, if not the top, I've heard statistic for mental health disorders that ends in death. And just because of what you do to your body. And
yes, that really that's really important for the listeners to hear.
Yeah.
But go on with your story, because I read that the leading cause of death in females between 15 and 24 is sometimes it's suicide as a result of bulimia and anorexia, but oftentimes it's just their bodies breaking down and anyway, go on with your story.
Yes. So, absolutely. The suffering is really immense, and it feels so difficult. But I had felt like at a certain point that I just completely, that's really what my 20s were involved with. It kind of kicked off when I left home at the age of 18. Different things trigger for different people when they're young. Some people begin to start having eating disorders when they're younger and they're still at home for other various reasons, like puberty comes on, or other anxiety. But mine was when I really left, the symptoms grew strong when I left and went off to college. And luckily I had parents. My father was a professor and an academic and smart, problems, but smart, and they knew they had something here that was troubling. You know, we didn't even have the word bulimia. It wasn't really known back then. This was the 1980s, and that it wasn't a thing. Like, I mean, I learned it soon, you know, this is called bulimia, but it wasn't like everyone knows it now, you know, that that's a disordered eating where you're either binge eating and then actually making yourself throw up, or binge eating and then running for miles and starving yourself to kind of make up for the binge. It's just some sort of purge flip-flop, you know.
Or using a laxative is another way to purge that many women use.
Absolutely. You got it. Using laxatives. Yeah. You got it. It's more commonly known, but I felt like I was the strangest person. What's wrong with me? You know, and I did many things, Overeaters Anonymous and therapy, and all of them had benefits that contributed. I would say probably the thing that helped the most, I mean, my parents were like, let's figure out what this is, and we're going to send her to a therapist. And there were several that I went to that were maybe kind of helpful, but not necessarily, maybe they had a little something. But when I found a group therapy, and it wasn't specifically, interestingly enough, for eating disordered people.
Oh, like, that's interesting.
Yeah, and there is something about that was incredible for me, because I had so much shame, and these people feel like normal, I could call it like normal, quote-unquote, people, or else they had something else, like maybe quite strong anxiety, kind of like the what do they say, walking wounded, you know.
Yes.
Functioning in life, nothing, you know, seeking therapy, knowing that they have some trouble, but it just wound up being the therapist that I was referred to by somebody I really, really trusted, and it must have been the 10th therapist I went and saw. She had these groups, and she would just funnel everybody that she worked with, no matter what they had. She kind of made lighter of it, like, you don't have to figure out your entire life history and be all peaceful with it to stop having disordered eating, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there was just, it was really great to learn sort of present moment experience of working with these people that were in the group, like how to actually communicate and express your feelings and be honest and talk to them about what goes on for me. I was totally quiet for like 6 months. I tell the story sometimes. And then I finally spoke up about what it was like when I binge ate. And so telling other people and not having them run out of the room was what I imagined
yes.
would happen. And they were very accepting. And that was the beginning of the end of my eating disorder, the real severe behavior. Later, I still would feel sort of angst and anxious. In some ways, I think I entered a period of life when it seemed more like what was considered normal out in the world, like, oh, all people are upset with their bodies just a little bit. Like, you can't really like your body. There's lots of group, I should really lose 20 pounds or 10 pounds or all kinds of different eating diets to go on. And like a lot of self-criticism that seemed more quote-unquote normal. It wasn't severe disordered eating, but people would be really quite critical and judgmental of themselves, especially women. And I felt like that was kind of running still a bit around my body image for another 10 years.
And if I may just interject something here, I think you mentioned to me in our pre-interview, and then I know this to be true, that perfectionism is one real predictor of anorexia. And then anorexics are prone to orderly, obsessive, compulsive thinking, and often are relentless when in pursuit of a goal.
Oh my gosh!
And and then bulimics, because you had both, didn't you?
I did.
Yes.
I went,
and they often do go together, or that one evolves into the other, the next one. But bulimics often suffer profound mood swings, as well as high anxiety that they just find intolerable.
Yes, I would say that.
Could you say that was true of you as well?
Yes, I would say that was definitely true of me. Mood swings is that'd be the word for it. Yeah. You know, really depressive and then kind of hyper, you know, giddy and then depressive and anxious, very anxious. Probably the anxiety was there before any disordered eating was ever there. Now, I'm sure that I was developing anxiety. It was coming on when I was starting to be going through puberty, basically. And and the perfectionism, I agree. I think it's very strong. It's like, I just must be perfect. You know, like if we just fix this little thing, even if you get quite in incredibly good shape, you know, but we could improve a little, you know, is kind of the idea. And that can be very, very stressful. Really hold
of
that.
Of course.
Yeah.
And then, Grace, you add to that some of the brain happenings, because what I know to be true is that an anxiety disorder often underlies anorexia and bulimia. And so binging and purging can ease anxiety because, guess what? It alters the brain chemistry. And some women, and, you know, I'm going to say women because most people who suffer from these illnesses are women, but some are men, but we'll use the word women for the purposes of this discussion. But so when women are consuming massive amounts of complex carbohydrates, the brain's levels of serotonin, of course, serotonin is a mood elevator, so they'll down the carbs, and then the woman may feel calmed, but only until panic sets in about weight gain. And then they often induce vomiting, and the body releases vasopressin, and that is a natural sedative. So what happens is when I think this brain part of it is fascinating. When bulimics stop these behaviors, anxiety breaks through because it's no longer masked.
I think that's probably true. It is, so it's like working and looking with the mind, which I love. I mean, I have loved what I found with looking at mindfulness and looking at the mind and kind of the root, like the way the mind is working and like what you're saying, where you've got this kind of response to, you know, sort of a fearful response to what's happening in life, whatever's going on around you or your ideas and your thoughts. And then, of course, like that urge to quickly, panic. Sometimes a binge eating, if I think about it, would feel like panic eating. You know, like you're just...
Panic eating, yes.
Yes, you know, it's got a lot of energy of panic. And so, you know, really looking at that, noticing it, even being compassionate for the self. I mean, it's a learned, because I think we also have a wiser, higher mind, you know, that is able to relax and not be completely drowning in all of it. And wonderful to be able to tap into that part of ourselves to heal, you know, and not hurt ourselves with food like I used to. Yeah, or with our
family. How long did your own recovery take? And I know it's a process, and that's what you stress with your own retreats and groups, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
How long did your particular journey to recovery take?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think in some ways there were some, you know, like trying what's there for just general mental health, and maybe some of it worked and some of it was interesting, but not necessarily an answer. You know what I mean? Like there's just so much. There's so much available. And of course, I felt very, very passionate about just learning everything I could about the mind and mental health and peace. And so I would say when I came across the work of Byron Katie and being, or more mindful self-inquiry, like being able to ask, is it true about what I'm thinking? You know, that was just so great for me. It just really, so something kicked in and I would feel like, oh, now I have this practice, plus being introduced to meditation and being able to relax, even if the mind is, you know, getting really upset and freaking out. doesn't have to be all of you that's freaking out, you know, noticing just some, so I would say, you know, good question about the timing. I just, when I kind of found the pieces and the tools that worked for me, then there was, it was quick. It, from that point forward, like when I was in that group, there was a huge jump into the behaviors not being so intense at all anymore. Maybe some of the thinking's still there for sure, but just stopping binge eating and stopping purging, that was amazing. And that was just kind of a breakthrough, you know, a breakthrough experience where from that point forward, it was never there again. So I'm sure
you were fortunate, but I think that your motivation and your intelligence and also your EQ, your emotional intelligence, probably, and then you, I've met your mother, it's been a while, but you have a good mother. So,
I know, she's so great. She was there, too. She was really trying to, you know, she's amazing because she talks about realizing and discovering, she didn't share this with me until later, you know, into our lives a little bit, that realizing she had her own attitudes about eating and that she even feels like, you know, I kind of had an eating disorder. I mean, she actually said it that way, even though it was never hospitalization kind of physically threatening in the same way, that she was very, you know, upset about her body, upset about her eating. She talks about always trying to lose weight when she was a younger woman. And, doing her own work around that and going to therapy and kind of stabilizing and finding peace with it a little bit later in life. And so she and I have been able to talk about that and the influence because we went on a diet together when I was 14.
In my work with people with eating disorders, there is so often the mother-daughter connection.
Yes. Oh,
and
my goodness.
You know, and there's some theories that there may be, in addition to many other things, a genetic component to this. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it's interesting.
And, you know, parents can really demonstrate what mindful, pleasurable eating is if they do it.
Kind of like putting your own oxygen on in the airplane that they always say, you know, put your oxygen on yourself first and then your child. And I think she realized, you know, my mother realized just because it was so, she looked at it, the culture as it's so favorable to be thin. You must be thin to be an attractive and appealing woman. And I don't think she was thinking I was not thin, but she was thinking, oh, that would be great for Grace to learn. I'm the oldest daughter. We can do this together. I always need to lose a little few pounds. You know, she had that kind of attitude. So we did on this low carbohydrate diet where we actually completely cut out sugar and we had it once a month. And one dessert, one time a month. And of course, what happens when anybody is, you know, faced with this thing that you like, or you've got to be very careful. I want you to be nervous and scared about this thing called sugar or dessert. And also, by the way, now you're hardly ever going to have it. I mean, you get all the, you know, kind of, you want it more. At least that was my experience is after that, I wanted sweets more. I don't even remember wanting it that much before then. Isn't that funny?
Yes.
So
that which you can't have or you're deprived of, then you want more. It's fairly common. And I remember some of my clients saying that their mothers would take them to Weight Watchers meetings. Then another one, the mother took her to a spa, and she was exposed to all of these beautiful mothers who were very slender, and we equate slenderness with beauty and success. And oftentimes, I mean, it's part of the culture. And but more and more people are caught in the grip of eating disorders, and so we need better treatments and perhaps a dramatic shift in our cultural attitudes, too. So that's why you, Grace, and I are having this discussion on the first radio day that I'm doing Progressive Radio Network.
I love that you mentioned that about what needs to change in the culture. Wouldn't that be more peaceful if everybody wasn't so hyper vigilant about or hyper concerned about it? And, you know, I just did want to mention that more and more I've encountered men from my work with people, and they feel quite ashamed. And I think in some ways the men that are suffering from eating disorders, disordered eating, disordered thinking, just any kind of behavior that's off balance with eating, have been keeping it to themselves longer. They have felt, you know, really anxious about it, because it's sort of like, is that a feminine kind of disease or something right wrong with me? So they have felt some shame, but more are beginning to talk about it as well, because there are some things like wrestling where you have to weigh in at a certain weight, or
I was just going to say that there are quite a few wrestlers who develop eating disorders. But the culture where how we look is so important.
Absolutely.
So if you out there are listening, and most of my listeners actually listen to the archived show. It'll be archived by tomorrow morning, because we're in Seattle and Progressive Radio Network is in New York. So it'll be archived by tomorrow morning, and so we need to really give men a voice here too, because they do have some problems with this. As you said, there's also the shame.
Yes.
This is a woman's disease.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe sometimes, I mean, it doesn't matter even the sexual orientation at all. You know, it's like maybe some initially, it has been a little more in the gay culture among men, appearance and that might be a little more of a kind of, heightened in the very generalized sense, and a little less shame about coming forward around that, like having eating issues. But I'm glad when men who are heterosexual as well and come forward about it, and sometimes they are brave enough to even attend a retreat of mine where they might be only two men there and the rest are women, or there's only two men in the, you know, the online program or something, but they get, it's the same. It's the same for them. And I love that they feel brave enough to be honest about what's happening. And anyone can study peace. You know, I like to say, if you need to be obsessed, get obsessed with peace.
That's very good. Grace, would you please? I mean, your two websites, which I hear from you, are going to be merged at some point. But you have workwithgrace.com and eatingpeaceprocess.com.
Yes.
And you have a video on Work with Grace. I couldn't bring up the Eating Peace Process video, but your other video on Work with Grace, it might have been my computer, but these are very good, and so talk about that and what you and how you can work with people that are not in Seattle.
Oh yeah, wonderful! Thanks for asking. It's funny. I'll say a little bit about why two websites. One, Work with Grace, was my initial business, which was started about, gosh, it's over 15 years ago. that I started working with people and then became full-time practice. And it was mainly doing the work of Byron Katie, self-inquiry, mindfulness, self-compassion on many topics, not necessarily saying, oh, and I'll work with you if you have eating issues, because that was my history. In fact, I almost kind of stayed away. I would mention it sometimes as like a really troubling thing or relatable with people. And what I, and people would ask me more and more like, well, can we do this, like the work of Byron Katie and mindfulness around eating? You know, could you have an eating peace retreat or an eating retreat? And I finally did. I was sort of like, I don't know. And then I did, and I've just loved it ever since. And it's been fascinating to find the best practices and what works for different people, because they kind of come in different needs to this.
That's right.
And
yes.
You know, different personnel, different places, you know, in their process and in their healing or what they're looking for, and all ages. But that's why I wind up making the different website, Eating Peace Process. But I actually have a YouTube channel, and almost all the weekly YouTubes that I do there are about eating little videos. So people on my mailing list get to see those and watch them. And that's really sweet. I did had to do an interview even with Byron Katie about eating specifically.
Oh.
And healing and eating. So that's on my YouTube channel. It's really very fascinating. Wonderful. Because she knows that I like to work with people on eating issues. So.
And she knows, because you became a certified facilitator of hers.
That's right.
She knows that you're really good at this.
Yes.
Working with people, listening to people, being compassionate, and knowing that many people have a hunger that's hard to name.
Yes.
And they yearn for big answers to live a big life, but they have to start with their most basic fears.
Yeah. Those fears. They really... You know, you might know you've got a hunger for something, and then here comes the fear, and it kind of chops that movement forward towards what you're interested in or eager for, what excites you. Yes. Yeah. So you and I were talking about, and just to finish your other question, too, about how people work with me, I did eventually create a program called the Eating Peace Experience. That's something people can do online, where we do a lot of live work, but there are pre-recorded, you know, videos and webinars and lessons with ideas for mindful eating and people being in a group together, which I think is so important. So that's about to have its, I don't know how many times I've done it now, gosh, and every time it's new and different. Maybe.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And group work can be so powerful. When one person is working, another is working. Hearing that person's story.
Exactly. Listening and sitting in the work and being there, it's just so helpful. Oh, I mean, I have found that helpful for me, you know, just wonderful to hear people's stories. So, yeah.
And speaking of hearing people's stories, so there is a documentary that I saw in October. It came to Seattle, and it's called I Am Maris, M-A-R-I-S. And the website is iammarismovie.com, and it's available on Netflix, iTunes, Amazon Prime, and it's a powerful movie. Now, the reason I know about this is that my niece's stepson is her boyfriend of several years now, and they live in the Bay Area. And she's a highly intelligent woman and a perfectionist and all of those things. And she also was hospitalized at the Lucile Packard Hospital in Stanford. And... She did everything that the people in the hospital asked because she was very anxious to get out. And and there was a part of her that didn't really want to change. I mean, it took a while. And she didn't really, like a lot of anorexics, bulimics, she didn't really think she looked that thin. But because she couldn't be objective. And so, but I think she realized, and it's a very, it's a beautiful documentary, just beautiful. So I would encourage you to see it too, or mention it to your group, and we're mentioning it on the air now. And she was there in person. This was held in Seattle at the Yoga Store. What is the name of that in University Village? They have a big group room there. So, and Maris became a certified yoga instructor, which. And she was very young to do that, but that really helped her to have this purpose and to share her story with others. And but she did a lot of work. And what was she afraid of in life? And what was maybe at the root of her problems? And yes. Beautiful. And then she learned, as you did, I'm sure, and you share with your. Your clients, you learn how to connect food phobic thoughts to upsetting events or feelings. Making those connections is very powerful.
And I, it's almost like you have this, talking about the brain, but like a automatic sort of a trigger or a cue, for, you know, like an, even a memory of like, this thing is something's anxiety provoking, and then it gets paired with, so let's go eat. Eat something.
Exactly. Let's go eat.
Eating will make you feel better. And, you know, it's got kind of a, I really do think of it as, in the most basic, you know, very generalized form, as like a form of fear, kind of survival mechanism, you know, that kind of just intensity, especially when I remember what we mentioned earlier, like panic eating, but there's graze eating or kind of boredom eating, like this moment isn't enough. I want to fill it up with a little something else, or it's, you know, I'm kind of bored, which is sort of, it's got a low level anxiety to it. You know, I need to be entertained or something should be happening, you know, a little frustrated, up to things where you're really fairly anxious and you feel like you need to do something about your anxiety. And it just gets really so closely associated with food and eating. But, you know, I really do think you have that in the mix, but then you add my body image needs to be the way it should look perfect as possible, like we were mentioning before. And you need to be very careful about eating. If you put
very
that
careful.
In, you know, very careful. Be very careful. Then that just makes the eating part even worse. You know, the so you take those, if you can kind of take those out, it's a great starting point. Like, relax your ideas about needing to get the body perfect on another date that's not today. Like, in fact, just have peace be your number one. Let's just feel peaceful in the body today. That's really what we all want. Nobody feels great about eating and eating and eating and eating and not, you know, like just stuffing yourself. Feel terrible when you do that. Most people don't
like
that.
Sure, and it becomes a real cycle and almost a ritual for some. And also, I've heard people with eating disorders say that. I feel as if food and eating are the only things I can control.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an effort to control.
Yes, huge effort to control, you know, which is a great thing to, maybe one great question in that is, you know, what else do you want to control? You want to control food and eating. What else is needs
That's
to be
controlled?
That's a good
question.
And
what kinds of answers do you get when you work with your clients?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, like especially people coming at you, expectations from others. It often has to do with people, humans. What you've experienced in family and maybe in even what we're told is, you and I were talking also before this show about the connection between just considering sexuality, sexual connection, which is your amazing specialty, and this topic of eating.
Mm-hmm.
Those measurable things in the human condition, you know?
So we need to talk about that, Grace, specifically sexuality and body image. And so I feel like, well, in general, a poor body image often accompanies low self-esteem. So, you know, sometimes the physical imperfections that seem so glaring to us are indeed reflections of inner defects that women sense. That when we have negative thoughts about our bodies, it's often because we feel inadequate in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in my 20s and I felt less confident, a lover might compliment me on my body, and I'd think to myself, oh, doesn't he see my thighs? And at that time, I wasn't able to see my body as it was, as others might see it, as a unique shape embodying my individuality. And so at that time, thank goodness I got beyond this, but I believed I had to change my body before I could love it. Lots of women feel that. Got to be thinner, got to lose the 10 pounds, and then I'll get a better job, and then I'll be a better lover, and then, and then.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's really, right, it's very, and especially because so many eating disorders kind of come on when you're beginning the puberty to grow into an adult, and actually that's when it's sort of like, sexual interest, or you get attracted, or you know, to whoever you're noticing those kinds of feelings, and they're wonderful, but there's a lot of mixed messages about those, just like there are about food in some ways.
Yes,
you need to control it. You need to make sure you don't do it too much. You know, sometimes there's very old things that even come out of, like, I don't know, religious cultures, even if you're not necessarily religious family. It's like, oh, it's bad, you know, and kind of a checking to, is this bad that I feel attracted, you know, or terrible? I used to realize in my family, it was kind of shameful. Like, you don't talk about it, you know. We don't talk about, even if you just want to feel like you want to kiss a boy, or you get really drawn. And when you're 14 or 13, you know, that was like not spoken about in my family. Where there might be teasing that is kind of not really that nice teasing, you know. So it's got kind of a shadow around it, and so that gets all mixed into it. But yet the feeling of really wanting to be attractive. Like, be the one who others are drawn to. Oh, how wonderful! Because that's just a human desire, you know. Like,
sure, to be popular,
to be desirable. Yes,
to be desirable and popular. I talk about this sometimes as self-image neurosis, because it can be a way. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking a little bit. I'm talking about maybe a woman in her 20s, because hormonally, so many adolescents are, maybe they just can't focus on this as well or understand it. But self-image neurosis can often be a way to avoid being sexual, an excuse not to abandon yourself to another, because that's when you have the best sex, the hottest sex, when you can just let go and abandon yourself. And But if a woman is fixated on the girth of her thighs or the tilt of her breasts or the width mm-hmm. of her hips, guess what? She may lose some sensitivity to her partner and be unable to communicate that she cares for him. And it's a very self-defeating form of sexual narcissism, really, because she's preoccupied with her own anatomy and not thinking about her pleasure or her, not always, but can't think as much about her pleasure and her partner's pleasure. Because the primary way that you're able to enjoy sex is to focus on pleasure. If you've got all these distracting other thoughts, that's not going to happen.
Right. Oh, my gosh. It'll keep him far, far away from that. And, you know, sometimes it's very, there's so much fear involved. At least I remember my experience in kind of connecting all that together and realizing, well, this is really in some ways suppressed. Like, you know, you're not supposed to be, it's sort of an anxiousness about being attractive and then also a fear of it, just a completely afraid. So it's kind of both going out at the same time, which is, I think, an interesting dynamic that happens. It's like with food, too, when you have this don't want it, want to keep it away to make sure it doesn't make you fat and you're, you know, it's a bad thing that you want to not be drawn to. And at the same time, then you just want it because it's so pleasurable to eat, especially if
yes.
you are starving.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you bring up something that's true. You're an attractive woman, objectively. I'm attractive for an older woman or maybe any woman. And what needs to come along with that attractiveness is that you're kind and generous, and you have fun, you have a sense of fun, and maybe some sizzle. I was very lucky because my mother sat me down when I was about 14, and it appeared that I was emerging into being a pretty woman. And she said, Diana, you've got to develop other qualities. My mother was quite beautiful, so, and she died a couple of years ago at 95. So, but she was a good mother.
Wow.
Anyway, she said, you've got to develop some other qualities because beauty won't necessarily last. Well, I think there's an inner beauty that does last. But she said, you know, develop your brain, go to college, be kind. And then I was also lucky because my parents, my father died when I was 14, hit by a truck. That was a terrible loss. But before that, when I was about in fifth grade, he and my mother told my sister and me the facts of life as we drove from Santa Barbara back to Los Angeles where we lived. So we were captive audience. And that was unusual back in the 50s for parents. Well, any time, parents often don't take the time to tell their kids the facts of life. And I'm so grateful that my parents did, and I was shocked. A penis goes in a vagina, and that's how you create a baby, too, and I was just shocked. Who would think I'd become a sex therapist one day? And I remember my mother turning around in the car and saying, Diana, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. Sex is such a beautiful thing, and her, of course, her caveat was, when you're in a marriage and you give your husband the gift of your virginity on the night that you're married, well, I decided I wasn't going to, it was a process when I decided to break up with a guy I was pinned to in college and where we'd had intercourse. We had not had intercourse, but had done everything but that was, you know, in the 60s. So
right.
Anyway, so I just was, and my sister, she was hanging on every word. She was so interested. She wasn't embarrassed. Anyway, I've come a long way. But I'm just acknowledging that I was very fortunate with my own parents, and I tried to be a good parent with my children, too, and my stepchildren. You have to be a little careful about that. But just giving them information.
Yeah. I mean, wonderful to just remember this sentence coming from your mother's lips. Sex is a wonderful thing. I mean, some people don't ever hear that, you know?
No.
And, that's really lovely. And, you know,
it is lovely. And, you know, my father and mother, I remember walking in on them once when they were taking a playful bubble bath, laughing, both of them in the tub.
That's so
great. It was a very, very nice thing. So it set the scene for me to be open and interested in sexuality, which is, of course, essential to my practice, and that I'm comfortable talking about sex.
Because
you're comfortable about talking about it too, and about disordered eating.
Very much so. Yeah.
Yes.
It's so important to communicate and talk. It's like sometimes that is a profoundly, you know, really open listening to somebody sharing about what they've experienced and what their ideas are and how their mind is working, like what they're thinking, what they perceive, what's painful for them.
You
hear it before you can move on from that and either like do the work of Byron Katie, like I like to do, question your thoughts, you know, look at it, see it could be a different story, reframe it, you know, see it differently. Just notice, oh yeah, that happened. I could see it differently now. So,
and it's true, Grace, that women who are far from gorgeous and not the perfect weight can often project sensuality and self-confidence despite their imperfections, and I'm going to put that also in quotes. Some women who are not beautiful feel very sexy and therefore can be very exciting in bed.
I talked
years ago when I worked in New York City, actually doing fur and lingerie modeling. That was an interesting departure. But I heard one photographer say that, and he was a photographer of really first-class models who were paid a lot of money, but he said, and this was in the 70s by this time, and he said a lot of them had to be plied with a lot of liquor in order to relax because they were not comfortable in their bodies. And so much in modeling, you have to project many feelings to be a good model. But one of them is not being uptight. You want to project what you're feeling.
How interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the key. It's sort of not being uptight with being in your body, feeling powerful in your body so that you feel clear and not nervous about people coming at you. But the same thing with food, like feeling clear and not nervous and confident and eating what you really want, you know. Not putting all those rules and regulations on it. That'll people know about that much more these days with that sort of diet mentality. I call it like scarcity mentality or restriction.
Oh yes, that's a good thing to call it. Yeah. Scarcity mentality.
Yeah. It's like I need to restrict this and confine it and control it and make it smaller so that I to be doing it right, quote unquote. Like looking at the world as right or wrong. I need to do it the right way. And then you know, those diets just start to I always say if people want just the first initial things around healing this in themselves is to be to just really watch and see what if you actually got in touch with what you really, really want. And no rules about not having that. You know, you're not allowed to have it. Like there's a person in the sky watching, which is usually yourself, right? But you've learned it.
Yeah.
You know, you've learned it. And just to let yourself be a human being in a body, enjoying the body and following that instead of all the control. And sometimes people will think they're so, those diets, kind of kick off something. And then, like my experience that I shared with you earlier, you know, then you're more obsessed with food. And like that yo-yo swing starts to happen, which we all know the statistics these days are much more commonly known, that you go on a diet, you might lose all the weight, but then you gain it all back. Because life, just being in a body, living in a normal way, you know, like a balanced way, isn't really what's out there. Usually if somebody has problems with weight or eating or binge eating or, you know, worries about maybe their weight is normal, like a bulimic and anorexic often, but they're just so obsessed with food or restrictions, restricting food, it becomes so much in their life. But I just will suggest relaxing and just seeing if you can drop the rules, just drop those things and go back to what it might be like when you're 3 years old and you're just following, you know, you eat what you need to and you love it and then you stop eating. You know, we don't even remember what it's like when we're young like that. Or maybe even...
That's right. That's right. Exactly. You enjoy the food you have and you savor it.
Yes. You just love it.
And that's the mindfulness part.
Yes. Yeah.
I want to get your reaction to this, too. So one woman who I remember working with, she moved away. She was in Southern California, and then she moved to Northern California, which is where I met her, and she finished college there. But she dreaded going home to Los Angeles, which is a pretty image-conscious city, let's face it. Mm-hmm. And she said, I felt more anxious and more judged, even by my peers, when I went back home. And so her therapist, and I was the second one that she'd worked with, she did some really serious work with the first one, taught me how to identify my feelings so that I could unravel the self-doubt and stop stuffing it down my throat, is how she put it.
Oh, my.
And part of her healing involved writing her father a letter. And in this letter, she demanded that he treat her like a daughter, not a girlfriend or a wife, because he was very judgmental about her weight. I told him that my body was my own and that I could do with it what I wanted, even if it meant being overweight. And if he didn't like it, then I judged him as a superficial father. I mean, she was she was very direct. She said it was terrifying. She said, but it made a difference in their relationship. It became a much more authentic relationship, the father-daughter relationship.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad. That's a sweet thing to hear, especially the understanding of the father, like the daughter to know what she wanted and ask for it and write a letter of her honest feelings, and then also for him to respond in a way that was loving and changing. I mean, you don't know how it exactly looked, but if they have a relationship, he didn't defend. He didn't just go into get angry and defend or whatever. You know, it can be very moving to speak your what's true for you. Yeah.
Have you come across Janine Roth's work?
Oh,
because I used her a lot when I was in Palo Alto, and her book, Feeding the Hungry Heart.
Yes, that's good.
And this is how women use food and eating and weight to express or suppress painful feelings about their lives, their relationships, maybe even their gender roles.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, she has done such beautiful work for all these years. I mean, just made a huge difference for me. It's one of the first things I read that I thought, wow. She has written a lot of books, and I think it was Feeding the Hungry Heart, because I think that might have been her first.
I think it was her first, and then another one was, Women Eating in God. I think that's how it went.
Yeah, Women, Food, and God. That was a...
Oh, yeah, Women, Food, and God.
Yeah, beautiful work. In a way, it's just such a wonderful, in-depth look at sort of the culture and femininity and really finding, too, that if you are... I'm right up along those same lines where if you are mindful and open and looking and willing to, you know, kind of apply peace to eating. It's like, that's, I think of it as peaceful. She has her, their eating guidelines, but there are things that are, that kind of support peaceful eating, like sit down at the table when you're eating, you know? And, I also recommend to people that they find what works for them most of all, you know, like, ultimately, what I've really loved is just finding that place that is very peaceful from the inside out. So I don't have to really, I'm not really thinking about what I'm going to have later on for dinner, you know, or tomorrow, unless I'm cooking, you know, the usual things that people plan for cooking and getting groceries and getting things like that. But it's just a non-issue when you're in between meals, you know, you eat when you're hungry and you enjoy it. And,
yes.
So ultimately it's finding out how that feels for you and being with that from the inside out. And, when I've listened to Janine, and if she's ever shared on a telecall or a podcast and read her books, then it's, I just sounds like she's has done the same thing, you know, just really in-depth awareness of the compulsion or whatever's going on, you know, the urges, the desires, and to make it your own. You have to find, you know, make it your, really what is you. You know the way they say, do you, like, live
do
your
you.
Life, do you. Yeah.
So we're about at the end of the program. So people can get in touch with you through your website. Is that through either workwithgrace.com or eatingpeaceprocess.com?
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Okay.
And they should have, you can get on a mailing list there. It's easy to unsubscribe anytime. I send regular things out and they can email me. Grace@workwithgrace.com. But yeah, wonderful.
Great.
Thank you so
Grace,
much.
You have been a wonderful guest, and I'm so pleased that I know you and that we did this show together, and we're going to do another show together on the 4th of February.
I
so
love
that'll
it.
Be
yes.
part
Very
two.
Very much looking forward to it. Yes, so good.
All right, and there's the music. Thanks again, Grace. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.
Happy New Year. Treat yourself well. Bye.
Calibro affascini il tuo cuore. E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore. Ma i tuoi piedi ta 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 ta.